Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire is produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host this week, Ife Adigbe.
And Amanda Wilson. In this edition, you'll hear a report on recent efforts to allow backyard chicken coops within the city of Winnipeg.
A very nice compliment to a backyard vegetable garden in terms of fertilizer.
You'll hear about organ transplant abuse in China from the author of a recent book on the subject, Winnipeg-based lawyer David Matus.
People are being killed in demand, so to speak, but once there is a demand for an organ.
And we'll hear our community radio report out of Cheam First Nation about their efforts to start a radio station.
I know lately, still trying to fundraise for the equipment that's needed.
But first, here are the headlines.
On October 22nd in Victoria, BC, a province-wide day of action occurred outside the BC legislature buildings. 2 days later, over 70 actions took place in communities across the province carrying a similar message. Defend our coast and to show their opposition to the construction of tar sand pipelines and tankers. The actions were directed at elected representatives within the communities. Over 7,000 people participated in the Defend Our Coast actions across the province.
The last weekend of October, PowerShift 2012 was held in Ottawa. According to its website, PowerShift is an event that aims to build an environmental and climate justice movement that can transform our society so that our future can be enjoyed by everyone, not only those who can afford it. PowerShift is organized by Youth for Youth and aims to mobilize passionate youth from affected communities and various sectors of civil society to explore multiple ways of taking action and work to develop each other's capacity and abilities. PowerShift is also about learning from each other, learning together, and using that knowledge to develop common strategies for creating positive change. PowerShift aims to ensure that once the gathering is over, our movement continues to grow through networks, common strategies, and continued capacity building. Climate change and environmental justice were two of the large themes from this year's PowerShift. The conference weekend concluded with a large rally, demanding that the government invest the $1.4 billion that it is earmarked for.
In Toronto, for the International Day for the Elimination of Poverty, the organization Jane Finch Action Against Poverty, which is one of the community's organizations, took to the streets to protest poverty and police brutality in the community. A local theater group called No Man's Land discussed the role of art in the protest and performed at the end of the protest.
No Man's Land started out in Jane and Finch. We're a local theater group, a poetry collective. We meet every Thursday at the Westside Arts Hub, and we basically get together to tell stories from the community, to give voice to issues that are affecting us, affecting people in the community, and affecting oppressed people worldwide. And so we channel that through art.
Institutions that do house theater in a conventional, conservative way, they are blocking the reels, like us ourselves. Like, we don't see things like this, or even subject matter like this, in the theater space. So we don't need that theater space. We can use it, but we don't need it because we got the streets, and the streets is free.
And it's really important to take up public space, right? It's really important to be able to do these sorts of art forms where people, the community, has gathered, right? And be able to empower ourselves and the community in the community. Right here on the corner.
In general, I think it's important to use art as a medium to empower community, and I think it's really important for us to take ownership over these different mediums that we have to our advantage, like spoken word, in particular in relation to hip-hop. These are art forms that came out of struggle. These are art forms that came out of communities that were and are still being oppressed. And in the mainstream media, they're currently being bastardized, being capitalized, and basically being used as a way to oppress people again. And I would encourage anybody who has a pen and paper at home, anybody who has a voice, anybody has any inkling towards expressing themselves, to use those mediums to empower yourself, to free your voice, and be a voice for the community.
That audio came from a clip posted by Basics on the Toronto Media Coop website. Daryl Richardson, Steve DeSilva, Megan Kinch, and Camelia Your eBay produced that report. The protest called for the end of vilification of the Jane Finch area by local media, such as York University's Excalibur, the end of police brutality and more community-based control policing, increasing welfare and disability funds, increasing funding to the elderly, and finally ending violence within the community. Police were on the scene, on foot, and two police cars allegedly charged the tail end of the crowd as it moved through the intersection.
And in Quebec, a legal battle is playing out between students. One student from Université Laval has successfully brought the former spokesperson for the student movement's largest association to court. Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, former spokesperson for CLASS, has been found guilty of contempt for allegedly encouraging students to disobey an injunction filed by a Laval student against picketing Laval classes. The statement Nadeau-Dubois was found guilty for was part of an interview he did on Radio Canada. "We find it legitimate that people take the means necessary to uphold the strike, and if that means picketing, we believe that it is legitimate to do," Nadeau-Dubois said. Nadeau-Dubois has announced that he will appeal the verdict and is calling for donations to assist him with legal fees, as he will not be taking money from CLASS, as he does not want to empty the association's coffers on his account alone. If his appeal is unsuccessful, Nadeau-Dubois will be facing jail time, fines, and/or community service.
And in Fort McMurray, Alberta environmental assessment hearings on the expansion of the Jackpine Mine project began last week. The shell mines will affect the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nations community, and the community has filed a legal challenge against the project application. The community is challenging the project on the grounds that the community has not been adequately consulted on the project and the impacts of the mine's expansion on the community's projected hunting lands could have irreplaceable impacts on the community. Actions in solidarity with the Athabascan Chipewyan First Nations community have been occurring over the last few weeks, with some demonstrators putting up banners in protest of the mines at Shell gas stations in BC.
And now we go to a headline from Carly Forbes regarding Canada's Supreme Court review of decisions related to the legalization of sex work.
On the morning of Thursday, October 25th, the Supreme Court of Canada announced that it will review the lower court decisions that could potentially lead to the decriminalization of sex work across Canada. Last March, the Appeals Court of Ontario ruled that they would strike down the laws criminalizing living off the avails, so that sex workers could now legally hire drivers and bodyguards. They also ruled that they would strike down the body house laws, so that sex workers could now legally keep a place to work indoors. Unfortunately, they also ruled that they would continue to criminalize communicating for the purposes of prostitution. In a previous interview with Keisha Scott from Maggie's in Toronto, she explains why it's imperative that the communicating provision be dropped immediately.
The communicating law definitely impacts sex workers that are on the street levels. And we know that largely those workers are Indigenous, racialized, and trans workers, and other workers that are living on the margins in different ways. So that takes away the right for sex workers to just negotiate with clients as far as what they are offering, their prices, and ultimately things that will allow them to work in a way that's comfortable and safe.
While the previous rulings only applied in Ontario, any decisions made in the Supreme Court of Canada would apply across the country. For the meantime, the laws are all still in effect. I'm Carly Forbes, reporting for Groundwire.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. That was Stay Calm by a local artist, The Lytics, from their album, They Told Me.
Now it's time for our feature stories. A growing food security movement is active at Winnipeg City Hall these days, pushing city councillors to allow residents of the city of Winnipeg to keep egg-laying hens and backyard chicken coops. As Michael Welch of CKUW reports in this feature, The initiative is getting some support in spite of ruffling a few feathers.
Within Winnipeg, there's been a growing movement to catch up with other cities across North America and change the city's bylaws to allow city residents to keep egg-laying hens in backyard chicken coops. There's been resistance to such moves in the past. This time, backyard chicken enthusiasts are optimistic now that they have support from within city council.
I gave an egg to every councillor today, eh?
Yeah.
The only side.
Harvey Smith, a councillor for the downtown ward of Daniel McIntyre, has chosen to support changes to existing bylaws. Under existing bylaws, chickens are considered exotic animals and as such cannot be raised within city limits. At the October 24th City Council meeting, Councillor Smith moved a motion seconded by another downtown councillor, Jenny Gerbasi, to have an upcoming city committee review these bylaws. Smith and Gerbasi defended their positions.
You're going to get eggs that are healthy. You don't know what you're getting from the store.
Mm-hmm. It's just to be able to produce your own food.
Right, is it more just real control over your own food supply? Like,
well, it can be looked at as an anti-poverty issue. It can be looked as a sustainability issue. But food security is really the issue that a lot of cities are taking steps on to support citizens who want to do that, who want to provide those, especially in inner city neighborhoods. It's really significant for people. I know I represent the West Broadway area. We have all kinds of food programs that have come from the community level, and they really make a difference in people's lives. You know, there's an independence, there's a self-reliance. And there's healthy food, there's health. I mean, there's a lot of issues involved. It's a very complicated issue. So this is really one piece of an overall food security strategy that I think we should have. So I certainly support starting to take some steps. I'm not sure the support is here from this council for this. That might be a little bit ahead of where some of the thinking is here. I'm not sure they grasp why we need to do this. But if you look at other major cities in Canada, they're doing this.
At the subsequent Standing Committee on Protection and Community Services on October 29th, more than two dozen people showed up to register their support for the changes. They were ecstatic to see the committee instruct animal services to consider poultry as one of the changes to city bylaws. The motion still has to be brought to the attention of the Executive Policy Committee and then City Council before urban chickens get the go-ahead.
I was really concerned that it wouldn't make it through this committee.
One of the delegations that attended the Standing Committee meeting was Louise May. She raises 50 chickens on her farm outside the city.
Of course, the reasons are pretty obvious, to be able to have a economical, fresh, healthy, much healthier than store-purchased eggs in your own backyard is a food security issue for everyone. It's a very nice complement to a backyard vegetable garden in terms of fertilizer and process, and you can feed the chickens all kinds of rejects from your house and from your garden. So it just makes sense. They're an ideal pet.
Councillor Havixbeck did not agree to be interviewed. However, she did express to the press concerns about urban chickens spreading avian flu and influenza. Louise May had this to say.
Let's say a factory farm on the outskirts of the city did come down with avian flu virus. Then if you do not have a register of all of the chickens in the city, then you are in a position of risk. That's what bothers me, is that they do not see how important it is to have all these chickens registered so we know where they are. So her argument actually is my argument for why we should have them, but not because avian flu virus starts with three chickens in somebody's backyard, but because we need to know where the chickens are.
The Executive Policy Committee will review the proposed changes at the November 7th meeting, and then if successful, the motion will go before City Council for a final vote. With the latest chapter of Chicks in the City, this is CKUW's Michael Welch in Winnipeg, reporting for Groundwire.
That piece was produced by CKUW's Michael Welch. Thanks also goes out to CKUW contributor John Wilson for supplying audio interviews with the city councillors. That was from local artist Ingrid D. Johnson. Song was titled Failing from her latest album, What About Love?
Our next feature comes from Burnaby, BC, on a new book that reveals the practice of killing for organs in China. On October 21st at the Vancouver Public Library, in an effort to combat transplant abuse in China, Winnipeg-based lawyer David Métis launched his co-edited new book entitled State Organs, Transplant Abuse in China.
New book reveals killing for organs in China. On August 21st, at the Vancouver Public Library, in an effort to combat transplant abuse in China, Winnipeg-based lawyer David Métis launched his co-edited new book entitled State Organs, Transplant Abuse in China. Métis said,
"In China, transplants happen in days or weeks at most after the patient puts in the orders, whereas everywhere else in the world it's months and years, which means that people are being killed on demand, so to speak, but once there is a demand for an organ, and the question is, where is this vast supply of people being killed on demand for their organs? Who are they?"
Several of the essays in the book conclude that a primary source of organs has been prisoners of conscience, specifically practitioners of Falun Gong. According to Amnesty International, hundreds of thousands of Falun Gong practitioners were sent to forced labor camps without trial after their spiritual practice was banned in China in July 1999. Some practitioners released from labor camps said while they were tortured, camp doctors gave them frequent physical examinations with special attention to their blood type and the health of their kidneys, livers, lungs, hearts, and eyes. China does not have a national organ donation system. Transplant centers in China increased in number from 150 in 1999 to over 600 by early 2007. According to China's Vice Minister of Health, Huang Jiefu, total number of transplants performed each year went from several hundred in 1999 to well over 10,000 per year in 2008. The China Daily newspaper reported that the actual transplant number for 2006 was 20,000. The Chinese regime denied the allegation of harvesting organs from living Falun Gong practitioners. However, the regime admitted in 2006 that most organs for transplant were from executed prisoners, which was previously denied. The number of death row prisoners did not increase accordingly during the same period of time. Human Rights Watch estimated that every year in the late 1990s to early 2000s, the number of executions ranged from 600 to 2,000. Métis estimated that every year to supply 10,000 transplants, 1,000 death row prisoners were killed for their organs, 500 transplants come from living donor relatives, 500 from Uyghurs, Tibetans, and Eastern Lighting House Christians, and 8,000 come from Falun Gong practitioners. Métis saw some positive changes since the illegal organ harvesting first surfaced in 2006. A few countries such as Israel and Malaysia have changed policies on transplant tourism. Live organ harvesting was mentioned for the first time in the State Department's 2011 Human Rights Report for China. On September 12, 2012, U.S. Congress held a hearing to investigate organ harvesting of religious and political dissidents by the Chinese Communist Party. Métis said the book State Organs is to keep the issue alive. The book is a collection of essays contributed mainly by leading members of the medical profession. It is a statement of the problem and a call for continuing efforts to combat illegal organ harvesting.
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. This week's report comes from Chiam First Nations, where community members are working on establishing a radio station.
In Chiam First Nation in BC, master student Jessica Benson is working with the Chiam community to set up a radio station within the community of about 250 people. The station aims to air voices from the community, improve communication, assist in preserving the community's language, and more generally broadcast alternative media. Now we'll go to audio from a fundraiser video for Puyallup FM.
My name is Jessica Benson, and I am in Chiam First Nation where I live right now, and I'm from Whitefish Lake First Nation on my mom's side and Rama on my dad's side, and I come from the Deer Clan. And we are an hour and 40 minutes east of Vancouver, outside of the town of Chilliwack in Chiam First Nation on unceded Puyallup territory. And I'm doing my master's in Indigenous Governance at the University of Victoria, and I'm all finished my coursework, and now I'm moving on to the community governance portion of my degree. So, and it's kind of like a practical application of a thesis where I'm required to work and live in a community, and then afterwards I'll defend in the longhouse here with elders, community members, and my professors from the university. So my project is to start up a grassroots community pirate radio station, which is Puyallup FM here in Chiam. You will be hearing from Celia, that's June Quip. She's my community governance supervisor, former chief, an active community member, and an elder in the community, and she'll be telling you a little bit more about the radio station and why this is so important to the community. So, miigwech for watching.
Puyallup FM is hopefully going to be a radio station that's going to be operated by the GM members and to provide information to the members set up programs that are going to help the community in different ways, such as the Halkamelem, the language for Chiam, maybe some tutoring programs, and also some cultural and spiritual music that I think will bring self-esteem to the community. It'll be owned and operated by the members itself, the Chiam people. I guess when we talk about Puyallup FM, and you're asking why, what is Puyallup FM? Well, Puyallup is actually our traditional territory for Chiam. Chiam's a village of the Puyallup territory, so I think that really makes a difference that we'll be recognized as Puyallup, we'll be recognized as you know, a community that's moving forward to improve the situation in our community. I believe that it'll really help even with the healing and promote inspiration to the members in what the radio station will actually be broadcasting. I think it's a good thing. It's we broadcast for a weekend, and it was really exciting. We not only got interest just from Chiam community, but from all over the world, as well as other First Nations that are really excited. And when we talk about the radio station, there's a lot of excitement that comes out of it, and what we could do with the radio station, what it could do for the community. I know we're still trying to fundraise for the equipment that's needed to get us set up. One of the options we're looking at is being able to be mobile. You know, if there's any kind of events anywhere, that we'd be able to pick up the station and go on broadcast from wherever the action is, as well as broadcasting right from the community. To begin with, I think we're going to need a lot of volunteers. We're going to need funding to purchase equipment to set up the radio, and also I guess some ongoing funding or ongoing funds to upgrade or replace equipment that we'll need. So, and also maybe having it so that we might have one person that would be we'd be able to pay to keep the radio station going, and help fundraise further for more you know, to keep more staff or more help available for the radio station.
We test aired the weekend of September 1st and 2nd using borrowed equipment from Suquamish FM in Esquimalt First Nation. There's a Shuswap Nation there. And it was a huge success. We had listeners online worldwide, and community members and local people tuning into 91.1 FM. And it went really well, and now we're currently fundraising for our own equipment. And for the basic equipment to get up and running and on the air would cost about $2,500, so that's what we're fundraising for.
In order to become a permanent voice on 99.1 FM, Chiam First Nations must fundraise $2,500 in order to set up the equipment for the station and finance startup costs. The station is looking for a radio transmitter, mixing board, microphones, a CD player, SWR meter, and a computer. Further funds would also be needed for staff members and everyday costs. Palalt FM broadcasted over the weekend of September 1st and 2nd on 99.1 FM and online. Here's some clips from shows aired during that weekend, available from the fundraising video.
My Indian name is Sophie's, and my given name is Zaya Douglas Nelson, and you're listening to Palalt FM 91.1 FM.
And you're listening to Palalt FM 91.1 on your FM dial. We're Palalt, we're polite, you mess with our rights, and prepare to fight.
We have some more guests in here. They got some drums, so why don't you introduce yourself?
Eastlat Sauktalskwi Talitlokwa Stailis Tanastala Talskwis Talskwas. My English name is Ralph Leon, and I have my son with me, Randy Leon. We're going to sing a song. This song is a ladies' honor song. We honor our matriarchs and our ladies that are carriers of everything in life. So this is a ladies' honor song.
November 1st was set as the goal for when Palalt FM would begin to air permanently if enough funds were raised. As of now, the site to make donations to Palalt FM shows $225 have been raised so far. Granwer was unable to get in touch with Jessica or anyone else from Palalt FM to find out what the station will do now and the progress of fundraising. If you'd like to get in touch with those working on getting Palalt FM on air and make a donation to the station, visit palaltfm.blogspot.ca to find out how.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire from CKUW in Winnipeg. Thanks for tuning in. We're Ife Adigbe
and Amanda Wilson.
Music this week was by Ingrid D. Johnson and The Lytics. Headlines this week were written by Carly Forbes and Erin Hudson. We also thank Carly Forbes, Erin Hudson, and all our other contributors.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.